Items number 20, the grouse management plan, we had to move this up due to some scheduling conflicts. So we'll have that grouse management plan update by Alex and Hillary.
All right. Thank you, members of the commission, Secretary Robley. I'm Alex Sol, a wildlife biologist for the state. Work out of the Huron office. I'll let Hillary introduce herself.
Hi, everyone. Hillary Morey with Game Fish and Parks out of Pier. I'm our environmental review biologist.
All right. So we're here today to share a little bit about our draft grouse, prairie grouse management plan for Game Fish and Parks. So just a little general ecology about prairie grouse in the state of South Dakota. We actually have two true prairie grouse species in the state. That's sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chickens. Sharp-tailed grouse is the picture on top. Prairie chickens are the picture on the bottom. They are generally grassland dependent. They are grassland dependent birds that are native to North America, medium-sized game birds. Basically, the distinguishing feature between the two is the shape of the tail. As the sharp-tailed grouse name insists, they have a pointed tail, while prairie chickens tend to have more of a barred tail. In the picture, you can see these males are actually displaying in the springtime. They gather on areas known as leks. These leks are located in intact grassland habitats, and are again known as leks. Because of this, they're generally the focal point of behavioral and reproductive ecology. First and foremost, again, prairie grouse are grassland-dependent species. They need a lot of large intact grasslands to persist. That's why a lot of this document that I'm presenting to you today is very habitat-related. But without a doubt, just managing for prairie grouse in a grassland system and a prairie ecosystem will have benefits for both game and non-game species alike that are also grassland-dependent. So just getting into a little bit of how we actually, you know, monitor or manage these species, we have a couple ways we actually survey them. The first one is obviously a hunter harvest survey that some small game hunters actually get. We've been doing this survey since about 1945. We also do an age ratio survey where we have wing collection boxes. The picture in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen is kind of example one of those boxes. They're located in the central and western portion of the state where we, you know, tend to have more prairie grouse. We encourage hunters to take one wing off of harvested grouse, place it in the boxes. Biologists will then take the wing, identify it by species, and then determine the age of it, whether it's a juvenile or an adult. From there, we can come up with an age ratio and get a good idea of what production actually was for that year. We take that production value and we can relate it back to weather variables that we experienced in the past summer. And this helps us develop, you know, future forecasts for how weather that we've experienced over the year might influence production in the future. We also have historically completed a traditional lek survey. So observers would go to a predetermined area, generally located in pretty good prairie grouse habitat, do a census of the area, count leks, or count how many leks they could find, record species, and then also do a high male count. We did largely discontinue this survey in 2019, besides one route and within the Fort Pierre National Grasslands, just because we're kind of like anything, looking to improve surveys. So we decided to go a different route, which I'll get into next. So kind of one of the routes that we decided to go to is we decided to, and this is a mouthful, develop a spatially explicit occurrence and density model based on landscape level characteristics and climate variables as well. I've said that in my head about 10 times and I can never get it right. But what we did is we actually worked in cooperation with North Dakota to develop a Dakota-wide occupancy model for grouse, whether or not grouse are there, and predictive density of grouse associated with landscape variable. Data collection started in 2010, was completed in 2016, and we searched 1 square mile sections. All in all, we searched about 865 sections, so we had a pretty dang good sample size. And this wouldn't have been possible with a lot of help from from a lot of good staff. So as a result, we were able to develop these spatially explicit maps. The ones on the right are probability of occurrence, or excuse me, the ones on the left are probability of occurrence. The ones on the right are relative density or predicted density of prairie grouse based on landscape level characteristics. I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of actually modeling effort, but generally what we saw is a positive effect with grassland and CRP, particularly for sharp-tailed grouse, a negative impact on with developed features such as roads and other associated infrastructure, and then shrubland, more specifically for sharp-tailed grouse. The hopes of this project was we could use this as a tool to kind of focus conservation efforts, because we do realize that prairie grouse are, again, a grassland-dependent species, and in turn, we have to, maintain and have the persistence of grasslands out there to even have these species on our landscape. So again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but prairie grouse are obviously very dependent on grasslands. One of the challenges that we face, not only as managers and as wildlife, management agencies, is the conversion of grassland. In recent trends, the conversion of grassland has not only reduced the distribution and abundance of prairie grouse range-wide, but especially here in South Dakota. That we have some information in our management plan, but it is predicted that since 1980, we've lost about 4.5 million acres of grassland due to cropland conversion. So it's a challenge that's definitely not going away. And this is also reflected in our harvest data that we get, again, from those harvest surveys. Generally, since 1980, we've seen a pretty sharp decline in overall harvest of prairie grouse. We have seen a few rebound years there. We've seen some spikes in harvest, but overall, just with the recent habitat trends, we're also seeing fewer and fewer grouse harvested. So that's where, this tool that we wanted to provide with our habitat modeling effort, we decided to develop priority areas with our occupancy, density, and occurrence models. These maps were actually made from our density modeling efforts. We decided to create a tiered set of habitat, tier one, tier two, and tier three type habitat. Tier one being what we view as the best prairie grouse habitat that we have available in the state. Tier two is just a little bit lower on the scale, and tier three is a little bit, even lower on the scale. They're still good prairie grouse habitat. They're just, we can make them better, obviously. The grade scale area is just areas that we've identified that are not prairie grouse habitat. They're not going to probably not persist there. They certainly could use it. And that's kind of one reason why we went more with the density model, is we wanted to put an actual value to how many grouse were there instead of just whether or not they occurred. This model in particular was developed for sharp-tailed grouse that I have on here. So our analysis region was 74,000 square miles. We excluded the Black Hills. We do know we have a few grouse out there, but just really hard to survey, and it's traditionally less wooded. So, we're just getting fewer grouse out there. But to put into perspective on how important these tiered areas are to prairie grouse, or excuse me, sharp-tailed grouse in the state, we analyzed East River and West River separately, because we know that East River habitat tends to be less abundant, more isolated. So we did break up the state in analysis areas, East and West River. So when you add up the total amount or percent of area of tier one, tier two, and tier habitat, or tier three habitat types, it only makes up about 18.7% of the landscape East River, and 56.3% of the landscape West River. But kind of putting a value to it, it actually supports 64% of our prairie grouse population East River and 87% of our prairie grouse population West River. So the areas that we've identified for this map, that just stresses the importance of the number of grouse that we have on these priority areas that we've identified. Going into our actual prairie chicken model, again, we truncated the analysis area a little bit down, just because we know that prairie chickens tend to occur a little bit more in the central and southern portion of the state. Our analysis region, again, in kind of the outline gray there, was about 24,000 square miles. Again, putting into perspective, when you add up the tier one, tier two, and tier three habitat types in, East River and West River respectively, it made up 11.2% of the landscape and 51.5% of the landscape West River. Again, values are pretty large. Those areas that we have identified, it's estimated to support about 67% of the population East River and 86% of the population West River for prairie chickens. So how can we put all this fancy map that we made use? You know, our priority habitat areas obviously are going to serve as an important tool for prairie grouse management. You know, the areas that we've identified as tier one habitat are areas where we can do local habitat improvements. You know, we already know that it's good prairie grouse habitat. We certainly can make it better. These local habitat and improvements or treatments, I guess you could say, are removal of woody encroaching species or the prevention of woody encroachment, because we know that benefits prairie grouse, and then also managed grazing systems. We know what's good for the bird is good for the herd. Ranching and our well-managed grazing and prairie grouse go really well together. So, you know, focusing on managing the grasslands properly is one thing we can do for tier one habitat types. Tier two is more of a landscape level improvement. You know, it's habitat that's there. It's just not quite as good as it could be. So these are kind of more focused efforts for grassland restorations, converting cropland back to grassland, as well as reducing developed areas, maybe taking out roads that aren't used, tearing down abandoned buildings, you know, that sort of stuff, in addition to removal of encroaching trees. But all in all, this will be this tool can be used as a rapid assessment for our environmental review process to determine, you know, what the potential impacts for, say, energy development projects could be on an area or in particular species. And Hillary will touch on that just in a little bit. So just kind of going to the nuts and bolts on how we actually manage prairie grouse. First and foremost, maintaining, retaining, and adding grasslands to the landscape has to be our number one priority for managing prairie grouse. The only way we can do this is obviously in cooperation with a lot of entities. I just have a few here on the screen of folks that we've worked with in the past, and they're great grassland management advocates. They're, you know, very good at expressing or letting private producers know what type of programs are out there for themselves to, you know, not only manage the habitat that they have or potentially the habitat that they want. So we need to continue to do so as an agency. Kind of getting down to a little bit lower scale. Grazing management, like I said before, grazing and prairie grouse, they can go hand in hand. It just has to be, you know, in a well-managed grazing system. We promote, doing grazing regimes that avoid some, you know, overgrazing and encourage diversity. Ideally, we want to have some sort of cover out there for these critters most of the time of the year. Again, they use grasslands exclusively for basically every phase of life that they have. So having some sort of cover out there, having, you know, diversity out there will certainly help them. To get a little bit more particular about this, we do want to provide about 8 to 12 inches of vertical cover within about 12 feet of a theoretical nest bowl. This is kind of the optimal range that grouse will use in the springtime for their nesting purposes. They do rely on residual grassland left over from the grazing season prior, the growing season prior per se, because they do nest so dang early. So having, you know, that kind of amount of vertical cover out there, going into the nesting season is what we deemed optimal. Again, striving for plant diversity, having different structure out there at different times of the year. We do realize that plants grow at different rates. They grow at certain different times of the year. So if you have diversity out there, you can, again, offer cover out there for these critters, depending on, you know, what life cycle they might, or stage in their life cycle they might be, or not life cycle per se, but stage of the year that they might be in. You can do this by promoting grass and forb dominated areas, makes excellent brood habitat. We have to have good brood survival to even get a population going into the winter time for winter survival, that sort of stuff. We do realize that some practices to actually get for plant diversity, you know, such as prescribed fire, heavy grazing, that sort of stuff, you might sacrifice a short-term year or two of poor quality habitat, but the results that you're gonna get in the long run are what we're actually striving for. I always say you have to crack a few eggs to make an omelet. So if you only have to sacrifice one or two years to gain maybe 5-10 years of good quality grassland, it's something that, you know, we should really take into consideration. And I've kept these grazing regimes, grazing recommendations, grassland recommendations are rather broad, and that's actually by design. We know that every ranching operation out there or farming operation out there is unique to themselves. We know they have their own way of doing things. They have their own short-term and long-term goals. So that's kind of where we want to relate it back to the entities that I had in the slide before, to meet with these guys, come up with ways to reach those short-term goals and their long-term goals that, you know, not only benefit prairie grouse habitat, but just overall rangeland health. last slide I got for you before I turn it over to Hillary. We are certainly going to advocate for, advocate for cropland retirement programs. Bringing cropland back to grassland. CRP is one way to do that. Obviously, we know CRP. There's a lot of literature out there that says CRP benefits grouse, and we've seen it ourselves in this state. But we do want to promote this with a few considerations. We just don't want to go out there and just put everything to CRP and that sort of stuff. We want to focus our enrollments to the CRP when we're specifically managing for prairie grouse to targeted areas. And that's where already adequate or near adequate habitats exist for prairie grouse, because that's where it's going to do the most good. And that's where our resources are going to have the best benefit. When it comes to actually managing what type of vegetation is out there, we're always going to promote, again, diverse mixes of grasses and forbs, group habitat, having cover, all that sort of stuff, predominantly native species. And then one thing that we do want managers to take into consideration is grass height. We know that East River, South Dakota tends to get more moisture than Western South Dakota, so you generally get higher stature grasses. We want to kind of promote grasses that reach a maximum height of about 39 inches, because that tends to be kind of at the optimal range that prairie grouse use and do the best in it. So if you're planting great grasses that are, higher stature grasses, such as a lot of big blue stem switchgrass, that sort of stuff, it might not get the use that you expect out of it for prairie grouse. With that, I'll pass it over to Hillary.
Okay, so I kind of like to think of my position as sort of a translator between what Alex has just said and a lot of the decision makers that I work with. So I work with the Public Utilities Commission. I also work with wind energy developers and various project proponents that come to South Dakota. So I like to take some of that really cool science and the mapping and habitat work that they've done and try and translate that into recommendations that they can use to try to offset any impacts to our native species. And in this case, we're focused on prairie grouse. So as Alex just mentioned, there's a lot of attention on grasslands right now. There's actually a National Grasslands Act that's at the federal level that they're trying to get through. But we've lost, I think, somewhere around 70% of our native grasslands here in South Dakota, depending on which part of the state you're in. And we also have a lot of wind energy development in our state with increasing interest in solar energy development as well. We have two permitted facilities so far in South Dakota for solar. And you can see in the map in the lower right-hand corner there all the wind energy development projects that are either under construction or already existing within the state. And we're kind of blessed, I guess, with a lot of wind here, as you all know. So there's quite a bit of interest in our wind energy resources. So what we're looking to do with the prairie grouse management plan is to kind of bridge the gap between the threats to grasslands and some of our wind energy development, renewable energy development in the state. So why did we pick prairie grouse? A couple of reasons. So this first map that I'm showing up here is the average wind speeds about at the height of where most of the wind towers would be in South Dakota. So the strongest wind speeds are kind of in the darker purple areas. And when we compare that to some of the habitat mapping that Alex and Travis have done, you'll see that it actually lines up quite a bit. So we have a lot of overlap between wind energy development and some of our highest quality prairie grouse habitat. And we know from other research, prairie grouse don't tend to like tall structures. They don't like transmission lines. They don't like power lines. And there's some research out there as well on impacts of wind energy development specifically to prairie chickens and some other prairie species, sage grouse, Columbian sharp-tailed grouse. And we all toot our horns a little bit, but we have the first ever research study on sharp-tailed grouse and or plain sharp-tailed grouse and wind energy in South Dakota ongoing right now, which is pretty cool. It's pretty special. So we're hoping to learn more about impacts of wind energy development on our prairie grouse populations here in South Dakota in the next couple of years. So you'll notice towards the end of the document, the end of the prairie grouse management plan, we've included this table that incorporates that model, the habitat model that Alex and Travis had worked on, and what sort of avoidance the developers have used, whether they are avoiding that really high quality habitat or whether they are not avoiding that really high quality habitat. And then we can provide a rating. So kind of like I mentioned, it's like translating that that science to how well are they avoiding the habitat, or are they, you know, maybe not necessarily targeting the habitat that's most important to our prairie grouse species, but we would like to see some sort of rating of how well they avoided it and how much they listened to the recommendations that we've made to them. And prairie grouse and wind are not just a South Dakota thing. This is a screenshot of the Renewable Energy and Wildlife Institute's homepage. So this is a national organization that works with wind and solar and wildlife interactions. And that's their homepage. They have prairie chickens in the background, which I thought was pretty handy for me in my presentation today. So this is a national issue that's been really important in the renewable energy space. So it's not just us that are concerned about this. Any of the prairie grouse species across the United States have been a lot of interest in from both the renewable energy sector as well as resource agencies. And we kind of looked at, or the approach that we take, like Alex had mentioned, is that grouse are sort of like the canary in the coal mine sort of thing. Prairie grouse are a little bit easier to see on the landscape than some of our grassland nesting birds. Grassland nesting birds tend to be really cryptic in color. They're not really easy to find, especially when they're nesting in the state. So all of these species that I've got up here are all examples of different grassland nesting birds. So we think of the prairie grouse as sort of representing this whole really large guild of species. And this guild of species in particular has seen pretty drastic declines in the last 100 years or so. So this graphic up here was taken from a 2019 article from the journal Nature. And they looked at different guilds of birds. So grassland, eastern forest birds, and grassland nesting birds had the highest amount of decline across all species in the entire United States. So it's pretty alarming, the decline that we've been seeing, we've been seeing in our grassland nesting bird species. And then there's also a lot of other really cool species that are grassland. We have a lot of grassland dependent or prairie dependent butterflies. We have a couple endangered butterfly species here in the state that are dependent on native prairies. Lots of really neat plant species as well. And when you hike with a toddler, at a toddler's pace, you find things like this thread-waisted sand wasp that you never even knew existed that lives in the grasslands. And of course, some of our other species are a little bit more visible on the landscape and that people are more aware of, mule deer and waterfowl as well. And just selfishly for me, some of my favorite pursuits occur in grasslands. I love mule deer hunting. I love prairie chicken and sharp-tailed grouse hunting. And that's part of our outdoor heritage in the state. And it's important to me, but part of our vision for the state is to also conserve our grasslands for the future generations. So that's something that I hope is around for a long time and that we can make an effort for conservation on our grasslands.
Good. With that, we can, you know, take any questions. You guys might have.
Outstanding. Does anybody have any questions? Commissioner Ristler.
Very good. Thank you. Alex, I'll start with you. And this first one, I'm just curious. It's about the survey, the first one that you don't do anymore. The hunters that would put the wing in the box, and you could determine some stuff by that. How do you do that?
Through the chair. So we still do our age ratio survey. The one that we, you know, kind of took a step back on was the traditional X survey. And that was for in lieu of this modeling effort that we did. So actually, you know, depending on the coloration of wing, it'll determine what species it is. And then if you look at the primaries, so the last two to three feathers for the length, or 2 to 3 feathers at the end of the wing, depending on their length or what order that they're growing in, which one's shorter than the other, that gives you as a good indication on what's a juvenile compared to what's an adult.
Okay, through the chair, I have one more question. That's okay. So then the second survey and monitoring that you did, and I apologize if you went through this, tell me again how you did that. Because I go back to some of the brood counting that I used to do at GFMP. How did that survey unfold?
Through the chair, are you talking about the traditional one or the one where we made the maps?
The maps, yeah.
So we basically, we took a bunch of random samples throughout the state. We stratified them by the amount of grassland that was located around a section. We